Here's one setup. A man walks up to you on a street corner, tears well in his eyes as he explains a heartbreaking situation. He says his 8-year-old daughter, Mary, is in the hospital with leukemia. Mary might not last long, and she's been through so much already. The worst part of it, he doesn't even have the gas money to go visit her. Would you help him out with some cash? Some of us certainly would, even though this is a well-known scam. Others would sooner part with a cold sore than a couple of bucks for this guy. Those people might be feeling sort of smug about now. But what if instead of appealing to your pity, the guy appeals to your pocketbook? What if instead of approaching you on a street corner with a cliche sob story, he presents an investment opportunity of a lifetime from a leather-clad office with a million-dollar view? What if he promises you an 8% return on your stock market investments every single year? Sounds too good to be true? Because it is. But that didn't stop a lot of smart people from believing Bernie Madoff and all the other cons throughout history who never did get caught in the act. These people belong to the one class of criminal widely considered artists. They have special skills in perception and deceit. Their victims, however, aren't nearly so distinct. Our guest today says that in reality, nobody is nobody's fool. We all want to believe, and a good con just figures out in what. She holds a PhD in psychology from Columbia University. As an undergraduate at Harvard, she studied psychology, creative writing, and government. Her articles have appeared online and in print for some of the country's most read publications, the New York Times, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, Slate, The Paris Review, The Wall Street Journal, The Scientific American, and many, many more. Her first book came out in 2013. It taught us how to think like Sherlock Holmes. Her latest work turns to the darker side of observational prowess. Fresh off the presses, it's called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Author Maria Konnikova joins us now to discuss. Maria, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily.
So, Maria, what drew you to go from writing about the greatest detective of all time to some of the greatest con artists of all time?
You know, it wasn't until people started asking me this question that I realized just how closely related the two books are, in the sense that I seem to be obsessed with the criminal mind. But the original impetus actually had nothing to do with the first book. At least I didn't see it at the time. And instead, it was inspired by a David Mamet film. I was watching House of Games one evening, and I don't know if you're familiar with the movie.
I'm not.
So the protagonist is a woman in her 30s. She's a PhD in psychology. She's just written a best-selling book.
Sounds familiar.
And she ends up falling for a really complex long con. And the thing is, she thinks she's in on it. She knows she's dealing with con artists. And she thinks she's a part of kind of the game, that she's getting a view into this world where really she's the target the whole time. And the movie ends with her having lost, you know, her money, her life, her practice. She's just absolutely devastated. And I remember finishing it and saying, wow, first of all, I can relate to her. Secondly, she's not who I think of as a victim. She, if anyone would know the quirks of human nature, it should be a practicing psychologist. She was a clinical psychologist, so she actually saw patients and was supposed to be someone who knew better. And so I wondered, well, how much of this is fiction and how much of it could actually happen? Could this happen to me? So I started researching it, and I realized that no one had ever really posed that question, and no one had written about it at length. And I became obsessed with it and ended up spending 3 years of my life to try to figure it out.
I think it's so it's interesting, a little bit ironic that you didn't see the relationship between Sherlock Holmes and you know, the criminal mind as you explored in this book, because so much of the book, The Confidence Game, seems to center around our blind spots and how we don't see things if we are too close to them or if we already believe in them. You write in your introduction that it's the oldest story ever told. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that con artists are as old as human nature. Just because it's very fundamental to us to want to believe in a world that makes sense. So from the moment that we're born, as infants, we kind of explore the laws of cause and effect. We figure out, oh, if I drop this ball, it's going to fall to the floor. That's what happens. And if mommy leaves the room, but then I cry, she's going to come back. Cause, effect, action leads to result. Things happen for a reason. As we get older, though, that explanatory need serves to not just make sense of the world on a physical level, you know, what is this strange place I live in, but on a more spiritual and emotional level. It never goes away. And what ends up happening is something that William James, one of the first great psychologists of the end of the 19th, early 20th century, put it, is overbelief. So there are certain things that we take on faith that we don't have any evidence for, and yet we believe it anyway. And I explore this connection between, you know, the reason that con artists are ubiquitous in every single society, I think are some of the same reasons why we get spontaneous organized religion in every society and have since the birth of humanity, because we have a very deep-rooted need for meaning.
Why do you think we call them artists and not just con jerks?
Because I actually think that they are artists. If you think of criminals, most of them, you know, they actually commit crimes. They will break into your house. They will pickpocket. They will do something that actually involves breaking the law. If you look at what con artists do, they often don't actually break any laws. They don't steal from you. They make it so that you give them willingly your money.
Mm-hmm.
They don't actually, you know, ask you for anything. You willingly give them your trust and your confidence and your love sometimes. I mean, a lot of scams have nothing to do with money. They're much more emotional and I think much more devastating when it plays out in that way. And so there, it's an artistry because we do everything willingly. We don't actually need them to trick us.
We're talking with Maria Konnikova, the author of The Confidence Game, Why We Fall for It Every Time. Hope you'll join this discussion with your comments by phone or by email. That information is on the way after a short break here on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host today, Emily Curitan. On the Jefferson Exchange, we're talking with Maria Konnikova today, and you. The phone number is 800-838-3760, or email us, jx@jeffnet.org. We want to hear about situations where perhaps your belief outpaced something you knew better. The subject today is the confidence game and the confidence artist. Now, Maria, what are the principles of a con, whether it's something like a magic trick, a ball under a cup, or something longer like the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme? Maria, are you still with us?
I am. I'm still here.
All right.
So I think at the most fundamental level, it's all about manipulating your perception about the world. And so a magic trick, you know, the best magicians, they're not necessarily the people who are the best operators, who have the best sleight of hand. They're the people who are able to control your attention so that you are paying attention to the things they want you to pay attention, so you don't even see the trick. They tell stories. They kind of divert you. They make sure that you're having a good time while the trick happens. And that is their magic show. It's not just the trickery.
The storytelling.
Exactly. And that's exactly what a con artist does on a much broader level, except now, instead of cup and balls and manipulating your perceptions of the physical world, kind of those types of things, now you're looking at your beliefs about the world on a much deeper level. And so they manipulate your perceptions about reality, not just, you know, is this card a queen or is that card a queen, but, you know, what is going on in my life? What kind of a person am I? What kind of a world do I live in? What kind of a situation do I find myself in? And at the end, they're the exact same thing. They're storytellers and people who craft narratives that we are happy to pay attention to and to be part of. I think everyone loves magic, and we love being a part of that. And that's the same reason why, when it's not even innocuous like magic, when we're talking about a con artist, we still on some level want to believe it because we love that story.
So you're describing cons now, storytellers, and the power of narrative to manipulate our perceptions of reality. You open your new book, The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time, with, of all the storytellers, all the con artists throughout history, you pick this one guy, Fred DeMara, a.k.a. Joseph Sear, a.k.a. Robert Crichton, a.k.a. many, many, many others. He's your introductory example into not so much a history of conning, but the psychological principles of conning. Why did you pick him?
I picked him because he was able to operate over decades, and he was able to pull off the most ridiculous-seeming disguises, from surgeon to head to warden in the Texas prison system to monk. He founded a religious college. I mean, this guy was just insanely good at what he did, so much so that he kept getting caught over and over, and yet he kept doing it over and over. He was on the cover of Time magazine. People knew his face, and yet he was still able to do this. And the anecdote that I opened the book with, to me, really illustrated a lot of what makes a con artist a con artist. And this is when DeMara impersonated a surgeon and actually got an appointment from the Canadian Navy during the Korean War to be the surgeon aboard a ship heading out to war. And so he was responsible for hundreds of lives. He was the only medical doctor on board. And out they go to North Korea, and all of a sudden he has to perform surgery. This guy has never finished high school, but what does he do? He starts cutting people open. So he actually had the gall and kind of that arrogance to think that he could pull this off. And lo and behold, he pulls it off. So no one dies under his knife. And he did have some help. He had a field guide that he'd conned another doctor into writing for the troops. He'd said, you know, if our troops go into battle and I'm not there, doctor, you know, could you lend your significant experience and expertise to creating something for them? And the doctor was very flattered and did. So DeMara had this. He had a medical textbook. He had lots of antibiotics, and he put all this to use in conducting his surgeries.
It is a kind of an astounding example of fake it till you make it. What's not clear to me, though, is what was in it for him, especially the surgery example. I think I've had a stress dream sort of like that, you know, and not everybody walks away, you know, healed. So why would you want to impersonate a surgeon?
Well, I think that that gets at the heart of actually what makes con artists do what they do. It's not about money. People often think that it is about money, but these guys are ridiculously smart. And by the way, they could make a lot of money probably in legitimate professions, sometimes more than they do as con artists. I think a lot of it is the rush that comes from the sense of power and control over people's lives. I mean, being a surgeon, cutting someone open, that's the ultimate control. And he was able, and he's not the only one, he was able to really kind of affect people and change their lives and change their reality. And he knew that he was able to do that. I think that that's what's in it for them. And they also, they have a sense of entitlement. So someone like DeMara, who never finished high school, faked being a PhD multiple times because the way he thinks about it is, well, I'm smarter than all of those PhDs, so I'm just going to take it. Why do I have to work for 10 years? I'm already better than they are.
Well, we're talking today with Maria Konnikova. She is a real PhD, we think. She has a PhD in psychology from Columbia University. We've got a caller on the line with some comments about the psychology of the grifter. I want to welcome Ed and Ashlyn to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ed.
Hi. I just wanted to relay a little story about my father, who was a psychoanalyst. And he... one time we were walking in the streets of New York, and there was a three-card Monty game, and he stopped to look, watch, and I was tugging at his sleeve and said, "Let's come on, Dad, that's just a scam." He said, "No, no, let's watch for a while." And after a while, he pulled out his wallet and put a $20 bill down, and pointed at a card, and the man grabbed the $20 bill and shoved it in his face and said, "You get out of here."
Because he'd been made, and he knew it.
He'd been made.
Uh-huh.
But also, my father was also invested with Bernie Madoff. And I want to correct your introduction to the show today. He was actually making 17% for the first few years.
Wow.
So you can imagine it was very enticing. And he refused to believe that it was a scam.
Yeah, your father understood the psychology of a con. Did he ever reflect on the Madoff scam and why he fell for it?
Well, I had told him it couldn't be real years before Madoff was exposed, and he refused to believe it. He was doing too well with it. So, he had limits to his insight. So.
Well, thank you for that, Ed. I appreciate the comment. Sounds like everybody has limits to their insights. Maria, would you like to respond to Ed?
Sure. I think that Ed makes actually a really perfect point, perfect illustration of something that con artists rely on, which is that when Ed saw what his dad was doing with Madoff, he said, "Dad, this is a scam," because he personally is not involved in it. So he can see it more rationally, more logically. He's an outside observer. His dad is in the situation. So for him, he doesn't see it as these returns are too good to be true. He sees it as, "Oh, I made a very savvy investment decision. And of course these are good returns because I know what I'm doing. I invested with the right guy." We don't ask questions when good things are happening to us. We ask questions when something goes wrong. We ask questions when good things happen to other people. But when it happens to us, we deserve our good luck.
Right. And the best cons, it's sort of unusual that we even know about Bernie Madoff. Do you think that some of the most elaborate cons in history remain a secret?
Absolutely. I would say that most of them do. We don't have good statistics on the prevalence of scams and conning in society because the vast majority of them are never reported. And it's either because people are too embarrassed. So, for instance, the Canadian Navy never pressed charges against Amara. They thought that their reputation had already suffered enough, and so they just wanted him to leave quietly. But other times it's because people don't realize that they've been conned because the con is so well executed that it becomes possible to just see it as a matter of bad luck. And so you don't see it as, "Oh, I've been taken for a fool." You see it as, "Oh, I was a little bit unlucky."
Right. So the mark, the person being conned, they don't have as many universal qualities as we might like to think, as people who say, "Well, I'm too clever to fall for that." Sounds like anybody, if you hit them in the right spot, can believe in something that on a rational level they know is false, but they never come to grips with that. I want to talk more about what sets the con artist apart. I mean, they have all these qualities that we really value. They're good listeners, they're intelligent, they're perceptive, they're audacious, and they got a lot of confidence, obviously. So where does the dark side enter into this?
Well, one of the things that a lot of con artists have in common is either one, some, or all of the so-called dark triad of traits. And the dark triad consists of, first of all, psychopathy, which I think most of us are familiar with. It's a lack of empathy. You don't experience emotions the same way as other people. And so it's that kind of callousness that will allow you to play doctor and to actually play with people's lives because you don't really care. You're not emotionally involved with them. The second part of that is narcissism, and that's that sense of entitlement and grandiose sense of self. And once again, if we use Damara as an example, it's what allows him to take the PhD because he thinks he deserves it, because he thinks that, it's just he's righting a wrong in the universe. The PhD was his to begin with, and so he doesn't have to work for it. It's his. That's the narcissism. And finally, there's Machiavellianism, and that's the ability to persuade people to do things for your own ends, but they don't even really realize they're being persuaded. They think that they're doing what they want to be doing, and this comes from Machiavelli's Ideal Prince. The Ideal Prince is able to really manipulate people on a masterful scale so that they don't realize they're being manipulated. And that, I think, is the type of persuasive ability that most con artists need to have in order to pull off the schemes that they do.
Maria Konnikova is our guest today. You're welcome to join the conversation, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. We do have the phone lines lighting up here, Maria. I'd like to take a call from Skeeter in Eugene. Skeeter, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm wondering if your guest can comment on the Gulf of Tonkin situation back in the 1960s, and also the whole entrance of the United States attacking Iraq, the war that we started there. Do you feel, and just looking at the Machiavellian sort of model that you presented a moment ago, do you feel like maybe the United States citizenry, were we conned by these politicians and anyway, I'd just like to hear your comments about that.
Thank you, Skeeter. I'm laughing because I'm looking at summaries of three different calls we have on the line, all referencing being conned by politicians or the government or kind of these sanctioned, maybe the longest con of all. Maria, do you touch on that in the book or have you given it a lot of thought?
Well, I think that there is, it's hard to escape the affinity between what politicians do and what con artists do. Because both of them, I mean, any profession that involves persuasion, that involves getting people to do something for you, is a profession that has the same sorts of soft skills that cons rely on. That said, I don't think we can lump them all together. And to me, it's a question of intention. So con artists, they're knowingly deceiving you. They're knowingly doing it for themselves, and they basically tell stories and pull off these schemes, all the while knowing what they're really doing and what they're telling you, and those two things are different, and they know this. A lot of politicians, I would say, probably their intentions are much less nefarious. You know, they often believe what they're saying, they believe in what they're doing, and sure, they have to exaggerate, they have to spin things in a certain direction, but we all do that to some extent on a daily level. And so I don't know that we can dismiss all of them as con artists. I think they just, their intention is a little bit different. They're not deceiving us on the same scale and for the same sorts of nefarious purposes. Of course, some politicians are probably con artists, but I can't dismiss the entire profession.
Right. And in terms of intentionality, could we talk about the making of a con? What are the different pieces? Specifically, it sounds like the first step is IDing your victim and figuring out who they are and what they want. You call that the put-up mm-hmm. in the book. And that's another thing where we're sizing people up constantly just to get through the day, walk down the street, know if we should be afraid or happy or whatever. How does a con size people up differently than you or I might?
I think con artists are the best intuitive psychologists that you're likely to encounter. Every single person, every single moment of every single day, lets off all sorts of subconscious cues about not just who they are, but kind of their inner drives, what makes them who they are, what are their weaknesses, their vulnerabilities, their hopes, their dreams, the things that get them excited to get up in the morning. We all kind of throw these little cues off, and con artists pick them up, and they're able to really glean our innermost desires from our interactions, from the things we do, the friends we have, the things we say, how we carry ourselves. And by the way, this isn't just in person. These days, they have a whole treasure trove of stuff online. All of these trails that we leave on a daily basis on social networks, on social mm-hmm. media, you know, when we have our Facebook profiles, when we tweet, when we share things, when we like things, when we create wish lists, when we check in places on Foursquare so that they know so much about us, they really create a pretty complete picture of who we are as human beings. You know, I'd venture to guess that they probably do more soul searching into us than we do into our own selves. So they probably start off knowing us better and knowing some of the motivations and drives that sometimes we don't want to admit to ourselves. They can see those and then they can exploit them. And I write that the put-up is in some ways the most important part of the confidence game. And I think that's true because if you really identify your mark accurately, if you can profile the victim and figure out the weak spots, the places that you can play, then you can really sell him anything.
So once you've ID'd your victim and kind of exposed their vulnerabilities, what's next? What's the play?
After that is when you actually start creating rapport with them to get them to trust you so that you can lay out what it is that you're asking of them in a way that actually doesn't make it seem like you're asking anything. You're just two confidants, two friends who are working together towards something. And so there are plenty of persuasive tactics that can be used, and I explore a lot of them in the book. But mostly it's a question of telling a compelling story that's going to engage your marks emotionally so that they stop thinking rationally, so that they become invested in you. They trust you. They think that you are the type of person who they really should be dealing with, and that way you can really start the confidence game.
We're talking with Maria Konnikova about cons throughout history, the psychology of con artists, and why we fall for it every time. Her new book is called The Confidence Game. Got callers on the line that we'll get to on the other side of a very short break. You are welcome to join this conversation at 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan. This is the Jefferson Exchange, and we'll be back in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. We are here with Maria Konnikova talking about the confidence game and the play in this case. When a con artist brings empathy and rapport into a relationship with a victim and it gets things moving, you can join us 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I'd like to go straight to the phone lines here to Carter in Wolf Creek. Carter, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
It's interesting about how deception is part of a plan for a lot of people to enhance from their point of view, their survivability. But what I have been most impressed with recently is a book called The Loneliness Cure by Corey, that's K-O-R-Y, Floyd, as in the man's first name. And the title of the book is The Loneliness Cure. And in there, he discusses about how we deceive one another oftentimes by the way we are affectionate with one another. In other words, false hugs or feigned care. And I commend the book The Loneliness Cure by Corey Floyd for anybody who wants to really improve the quality of their affectionate communication with other people and really reduce greatly the frequency of deceptions.
All right, Carter and Wolf Creek, thanks for that comment. The book we're talking about today, The Confidence Game, with Maria Konnikova. Maria, Carter does bring up an interesting point about the old deception in affection, and I'd say, you know, an exaggerated version of that is the gigolo, which you talk about in your book. What are the, I guess, the building blocks of a romantic con?
Yeah, and romantic cons are among my favorites to talk about because they really mean, there's nothing quite like a romantic con to tear apart the preconceptions that we have about who the victims are. So you've obviously heard the saying, you can't cheat an honest man. Well, what happens when you are a lonely woman, because unfortunately a lot of these victims are women, though one of the ones I talk about very high profile was a man, and you go on a dating website and you find someone who seems to really understand you. You build a rapport over months. You think you've really found someone you could spend your life with, and suddenly you find yourself giving a lot of your money to this person, because first there are visa problems, then there are medical problems, then, you know, their parents are in an accident so they can't actually leave when they thought they were going to leave. Then finally you give them money for plane tickets. Lo and behold, you know, you have no money left and you're still completely alone because this person took advantage of your loneliness, of your emotions, in order to weave this complex deception. And how in the world were you being dishonest? How were you being greedy? All you wanted was a human connection, which is a really understandable thing to want.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens all the time. And one woman with whom I ended up speaking for quite some time, she fell for a romance con at home. So this was not online. This was in person. And she ended up moving in with a con artist who had sold this entire deception. He was not at all who he said he was. So he ruined her life. You know, he deceived her in the most intimate way possible. And the way that it happens is you take advantage of these needs, these emotional vulnerabilities. Those are the openings that you need in order to get a lot of whatever it is you're looking for, that power that we were talking about, that control or money or whatever it is that you want as a con artist.
The perils of loving a con are probably too long to list. We've got a caller on the line. She didn't want to give their name, but it sounds like this caller has something to add about the effects of having a con artist in the family. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi,
are you there?
My grandfather was a con artist. He never went to prison, but he conned his two eldest daughters into sleeping with him, and he did go to prison for that. But my aunt, who was the oldest daughter, ratted on him because she didn't want him to move on to the younger girl. But it ruined the whole family for three generations.
And why do you see this as a con game that your granddad did and not just unspeakable abuse?
Oh, he was a con artist for a living. My aunt, who became an alcoholic, went through Alcoholics Anonymous, and she wrote her life story. She was dead when I finally read this, her letter that she wrote. And she said, oh, there were many times they lived in car camps is where they lived. And she said, oh, there were many times when we would pack up all the stuff in the car in the middle of the night, put a mattress on top of the belongings in the car, and put the little kids on top of the mattress, and then push the car silently out of town.
Mm.
When we got to a
escape.
New town, we had a different name, and she said she got so confused as to what name she was supposed to be using that it was often almost comical.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you for calling in and sharing your story. I'm going to go back to our guest, Maria Konnikova, right now. Maria, that's quite a story, you know, of a whole family being involved in a con, and also the line between, you know, exploiting emotional vulnerabilities. But at what point does that make you a con artist and not just a really crappy human being?
I think that's a really good question, and I think there are lots of bad people out there who exploit emotions who aren't con artists. And we were talking before with the politicians about this question of intentionality. There's another question of, well, what exactly are you looking to accomplish, and what is your end game here? Are you using this sort of deception because you have to, because you're someone who's kind of a small-time crook and you're doing other things and you're trying to evade the law, or are you doing it because you want to, because you've actually crafted this story, you're in control of it, and you've created this situation on purpose? And I think the latter is what a con artist is. That's what makes them artists. The former is what, frankly, a criminal is, who ends up using some of the same techniques of con artists in order to get himself out of jams. Good con artists, by the way, almost never have to resort to kind of law fixing or trying to escape legal persecution, because if they carry off their con well enough, charges are never going to be pressed in the first place, and a lot of people won't even realize what happened. And so I think that that's the distinction that I would draw here.
Let's go to another call. Sue in Mendocino County. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Sue, are you there?
Discussion. I was wondering if there's any predisposing childhood events or factors, mental illnesses, et cetera, that set someone up to go into this behavior. And I will take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Sue.
Bye-bye.
All right. Maria, anything to say to that?
Yeah. It's a really interesting question that Sue poses. And I do write that I think a lot of con artists aren't born, they're made. And it's a lot of predisposition meeting the right opportunity. And I do think that depending on how your life turns out, you could become, you know, an incredibly high-functioning member of society, or you could become a con artist. And it really depends on the luck of the draw to a certain extent. So someone like Fred DeMara, people say, well, was he always meant to be a con artist? Well, it's easy to think so, but, you know, he was born into a upper middle class family, and it ends up that at a very young kind of formative age, his family lost all his money, and he didn't want to be poor. And so he started kind of doing things to pretend that he wasn't poor, even though they were now, you know, not destitute, but very hard up. And then his sister dies, who he really is close with. She has a terrible freak accident, falls on the ice, cracks her head. And so all of a sudden he doesn't have kind of his confidant and a woman who really was a kind of a moral compass. And so he starts getting away with these minor deceptions. It works. He's good at it. And so he keeps doing it. Can one imagine a version of the world where his father never lost his job, where they never lost kind of their family standing, and he ended up finishing high school, going to college, and being a successful real surgeon? I could definitely see that happening. He definitely had the predisposition. Not everyone in his situation would become a con artist, but it also was the luck of the draw.
And the dark triad that you brought up earlier, the narcissism, the psychopathy, and the Machiavellianism that often go into the psychology of a con artist, are those considered mental illnesses? Are they conditions?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a really good question. And the answer, I think, depends on whom you ask. So psychopathy, yes, would be considered, I think, a mental illness. Or I don't know if it would be a mental illness. It's certainly something that's a diagnosable mental condition. It's in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So that's kind of the Bible for these sorts of mental illnesses. Psychopathy and Machiavellianism, narcissism and Machiavellianism, I think it depends on what level we're talking about, whether we get to any sort of clinical level. But mostly those two aren't really, they're not mental illnesses. They're just overly grand senses of self, I would say.
So we've talked about the play, which is when empathy and rapport are created, mm-hmm. you know, between the con and their mark. What is the rope?
The rope is where they actually bring the kind of persuasive tactics to bear. So a lot of these people might actually recognize from textbooks and from accounts of really rather legitimate persuasion tactics. So a lot of them come from places like Robert Cialdini, whose book Influence is not meant for con artists. It's meant for helping people achieve what they want to achieve in very legitimate and positive circumstances. And yet those exact same approaches can be used for much more nefarious purposes by con artists. And so these are the actual kind of tactics that you use to present the argument in the most persuasive way that's the most likely to get the result that you're looking for, so that people will really do what you want them to do.
In the confidence game, you describe a guy, Mervyn Barrett. He's a knight when he gets conned, when he gets duped. I mean,
yes.
Totally duped. How did that happen to a knight?
Well, so he ended up trusting. He was involved in a nonprofit that rehabilitated criminals, and he ended up trusting this guy, Matthew Brown, who said that he had been in prison and that he confided in him that he was basically an ex-con in need of rehabilitation. And he ended up being a volunteer in his organization. They worked closely together. Matthew convinced him to run for police commissioner. And not only that, but he said that he was going to be his campaign manager. And so he ended up getting access to his bank accounts, to all of this stuff. Now, Matthew was a con artist, so none of the stuff that he said had actually been true. And he ended up ruining this guy's reputation completely, because can you imagine what a laughingstock you become if you're running for police commissioner and it ends up that your campaign manager is a con artist who spends all of your money? So Mervyn Barrett, last I heard, so this was still in courts, so there was no resolution to this, but he had allegedly lost all of his money, or close to it, all of his savings. The campaign had never really existed. Everything that Matthew Brown said he did, he hadn't done. And so it was this whole convoluted scheme where he appealed to Barrett's sympathy. He appealed also to his sense of his sense of himself as someone who could be a police commissioner, who could make the world a better place.
Right.
Not because he thought that, you know, he was better than others, but because he really believed in these sorts of questions and he wanted to make a difference in the world. So once again, we see not a greedy, not a dishonest man, but a man who really wants to do good. And that's precisely the thing that Brown used against him.
So Maria Konnikova, before we go today, the $64,000 question, how can we protect ourselves without totally just losing faith in humanity?
Well, I think we can do several things. One, so that put up that we were talking about, when the psychological profiling occurs, when the con artist really figures out what makes us tick, we should do that to ourselves. We should try to examine who we are and what we really want. And then we should realize that if it seems too good to be true, it really is. We're not an exception, no matter how much we want to believe that we might be.
All right, Maria Konnikova, author of The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.